Well, our Bible reading today is taken from the Gospel of Matthew at chapter 22, and we're going to read from verse 15. Matthew chapter 22 and verse 15, as we read God's truth. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. They sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, knowing their evil intentions, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then he said to them, "So give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." When they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. "Teacher," they said, "Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her?" Jesus replied, "You are in error because you do not know the scripture or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourselves. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, "What do you think about the Messiah? Whose son is he?" "The son of David," they replied. He said to them, "How is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? For he says, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet.' If then David calls him Lord, how can he be his son?" Let me begin, though, by bringing before you what appears to be, there may be more, but what appears to be the two interview styles that TV presenters use today. One style is where you have the TV presenter who is trying to make the interview about them and to let the viewers know just how smart they actually are. So they will ask various different leading questions in order to try and trip up the person being interviewed and to almost gain the upper hand. The opposite interview style is where the interviewer is trying as much as possible to go into the background to enable the person being interviewed to speak because people want to hear what they have to say. I suppose if you were to illustrate these two styles, you would be thinking of Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain before he stormed off, as opposed to Parkinson. And if those of you don't recognize the name Parkinson, Google it, watch some YouTube clips, and see how he allows the person to actually speak. Well, in this passage before us in Matthew chapter 22, you have different people, different elements of the religious establishment of the day, who usually bickered and argued amongst themselves, strangely now coming together against a common enemy. The enemy is Jesus. And they're coming to Jesus with various different questions in order to trap him in his words. Jesus has been exposing what they are like. They are now going on the offensive. And the offensive is an entrapment strategy. And they come to Jesus with this strategy. It begins with this nauseating hypocrisy as they speak of Jesus in verse 16. When they say effectively, you are a man of such upstanding. You're a man of integrity. You are sincere. You are faithful to the truth. You do not alter what you say depending on who might be present. You are in a different league. In other words, you are somebody who tells the truth no matter the consequences. And here is another opportunity for you to do the same. And so they come before him with a series of questions that they hope have consequences for him. Now today, as we think of the answers to these questions, we are going to learn truths from the mouth of Jesus that actually help you and I to make sense of life itself. And that may appear to be a big claim. And so if you think that is a big claim, even more incentive to hear what these words actually have to say. Because the truths that Jesus delivers, as we continue our examination of the final week of Jesus prior to his crucifixion, these truths help us to understand life. Truth number one, God has a claim upon each one of us. God has a claim upon each one of us. This is given in the teaching from verse 15 to verse 22. It culminates with the answer that Jesus gives, which leaves the people gobsmacked. Will people pay this tax or not? Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, says Jesus, as he gives this principle. Well, let's take a couple of steps back. The issue here is a tax. A hated tax of the day. Those of you who were around at the time when you saw the poll tax riots that took place in Scotland a couple of decades back, well, that would be nothing compared to the hatred that the Jews had of this imperial tax. Now, for all of us, when we first encountered the taxman, it wasn't a pleasant experience. I wonder if you can think back to the occasion where you had your first paycheck. And you opened up the paycheck and you saw this tax and you thought, who's this guy? Why is he taking 20%? Why is he taking a fifth of what I've just earned? And we ask the question, is he going to do this every time? And this guy tax, that's what he does. He takes either the 20% or the 40% or even the 45% out of our salaries. And we can all think of ways in which we could spend that money, but we can't. It's given to the taxman. And if Jesus had said, nah, it's okay, you don't need to pay tax, well, we'd have probably celebrated with a statement like that. But that's not what Jesus does. Because instead, Jesus comes and he gives to the people here a principle. He asks for a coin. Well, whose picture's on the coin? Well, we've got the queen, they had Caesar. What's written on the coin? Well, it was an inscription, a son of the divine imperial, the divine Caesar. He's almost the son of the divine. Jesus says, we'll give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Now, the obvious question wasn't asked. The obvious question is, what belongs to God? If the image and inscription on the coin is Caesar's and therefore it belongs to Caesar, what belongs to God? And the answer is that you and I belong to God. The Bible makes it very clear that you and I, while being part of this created order, are different from the created order. When the Bible describes how this world came into being, the Bible describes the various plants and vegetation, the various animals and whatever else. They were made according to their kind. But for the human race, it's different. We weren't made according to a particular kind. We were made in a different mold. The mold that was put upon us, according to Genesis chapter 1, is that of the image of God. We were molded after God. Not like after the animal world or any other part of this natural created world that we have here. It is a mold upon us that's different. We have the image of God imprinted on us. And it explains why human nature is a nature that worships. And throughout the world, people will worship. They are conscious that they are small in comparison to something bigger than themselves, and they try and somehow relate to that which is bigger. And even in a secular society like our own, people still worship. They will be worshiping at the altar of social justice or worshiping at the altar of environmentalism. But that inbuilt understanding of worship is because we have been made in the mold and image of God. It also explains to us how we've got a sense of right and wrong, a sense of justice and injustice. It explains why we have got that sense of creativity, that appreciation for beauty, why we have that ability to self-analyze. These and others are elements of what it means for us to be made in the image of God. Now, as I tried to explain with the kids and with the football, you know, this is still a football, but it's burst and it's deflated. It's still a football. You and I no longer reflect perfectly the image of God. It's been graffitied over. It's been defaced. It does not perfectly reflect God as it was intended, but it is still there. So if God's image is upon us, then just as the image of the coin is of Caesar and it belongs to him, if the image of God is on us, then we belong to God. Now, this has two really significant applications for us. Application number one is this: you have a worth, you have a value, you have a dignity from the very moment of your conception that puts you on a different level from the created world round about. Every single human being, regardless of what environment we've been born into, regardless of our color or our creed, we have a dignity, we have a worth, we have a value because the image of God is upon us today. And nobody has the right to somehow devalue your significance in this world. Because you have a value, because the image of God is imprinted upon you. Yes, it is not perfectly imprinted as it was at the beginning, but it is still there. God has made you with the capability of communicating with him. You have a value and a dignity, and nobody and nothing shall undermine that. The other application is this: if we are to give to Caesar's what is Caesar, and Jesus lays down a principle of how we are to submit to the authorities and the governments of that God in his providence would raise up, that when they exercise their lawful jurisdiction, that we are to be upstanding individuals giving back to Caesar what is Caesar's. But what about giving back to God what is God's? If his image is upon us, it means he has a claim over us. Not simply a claim for 1 hour on a Sunday to attend a service or something like that, but he has a claim over our heart and our head. He has a claim over our time and our talents. He has a claim over our body and our soul. He has a claim over us whereby he is demanding our allegiance and our adoration because of what he has done for us to restore his image in us. What am I talking about? Well, the image of God still rests in the human race. But the undefaced, ungraffitied image of God walked on this earth again in the person of Jesus Christ. And what God is demanding of us, because we owe our life, our breath, or everything to God, whether we acknowledge that or not, it is simple fact. And God has his demands, his claim on our lives, that we would look to the undefaced image of God in his perfection, that is Jesus Christ. That we would give wholehearted allegiance and adoration to him, so that we might realize that the meaning of life actually revolves around knowing who we belong to, that we belong to God. So truth number one about trying to understand life is that God has a claim on each one of our lives. How do you respond to that this morning? Truth number two, a relationship with God never ends. After the first group had asked their question and were unable to come back to Jesus, the next group that came were a group called the Sadducees. And they were a group of people who were very much focused on the here and now. They didn't believe in miracles. They didn't believe in the afterlife. Their religious thinking was confined exclusively to the first five books of the Bible, the law of God, as it were. And as far as they were concerned, this was an opportunity for them to show how ridiculous it was, how ludicrous it was to think of there being life after death. And so they come with this situation to Jesus, a situation that is spoken of in the Old Testament as not simply a way of looking after vulnerable widows after their husbands have died, but also a way of safeguarding the family line. And so they come to Jesus and they say, well, okay, there was this couple and the guy died. The widow didn't have any children, so her brother had to marry her and they had children and then he died. But they didn't have any children either. So the next brother had to marry. And so seven brothers married this woman. They all died. So in the resurrection, who is going to be her literal happy ever after husband? And you can almost imagine the kind of dismissive tone in which they were asking the question. And if you've ever seen some interviewers on TV being exposed for their smartness, where they pick a clause of a sentence out and say, but didn't you say this? And the interviewer says, and the person answering says, yes, but what did I say after that? And what did I say before that? And as the before and after are put together, it puts a completely different slant on what's been said. And the person asking the question is exposed for the way in which they have attempted to trip somebody up. Well, Jesus comes back to them and he says, verse 29, you're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. Just as Jesus called out Satan when he took out a truth from the Bible out of context and twisted it, Jesus called Satan out at the temptation when that happened, and he calls these Sadducees out as well. And he makes it plain to them that they have missed something significant. If their focus is the first five books of the Bible, in these first five books of the Bible, does not God reveal himself in Exodus chapter 3 as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? Not the God of Abraham when he lived, and Isaac when he lived, and Jacob when he lived, but he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the God of the living, not the God of the dead. Now, it's true that death separated body from soul with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And until the resurrection of the dead, when body and soul will be reunited, there is that separation. But here, Jesus is reminding us that the relationship that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had with God is one relationship that death could not destroy. That God is the God of the living, not the God of the dead in that sense. And it makes perfect sense. Why would God protect us in life without protecting us in death? And of course he does. Because what Jesus is reminding the people of God here is that a relationship with God never ends. It is the only relationship that death cannot interrupt. We know to our cost that everything that is good in this life eventually comes to a conclusion. Either it fades or it breaks or death comes in and intrudes, and everything good in this life ultimately is impacted by sin. Jesus is reminding us that there is a good, there is ultimate good that is not impacted by sin. There is ultimate good that is a relationship with God that sin cannot touch. That a relationship with God, begun now, will continue through death and forevermore. And this is what the Bible repeats time and again. Let me just give you one illustration of that. Think of Psalm 23, how often it is sung at funeral services. The Lord's my shepherd. I'll not want. He makes me lie down in pastures green. He leads me. So God is leading us in life through the quiet, peaceful occasions of life. The promise in the middle of the psalm is that God will lead us through the greatest danger, the darkest danger, the deadliest danger of death itself. We need not be afraid because God's going to be with us. And he's going to lead us through that to a place where all of our needs are provided plenteously. And we will finish off, as that psalm tells us, dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. I said at the start that Jesus is giving us truths here that help us to make sense of life. Truth number one is that God has a claim upon each one of our lives. And he wants us to know what it is to be in a relationship with him, to have our allegiance, our adoration focused on the express image of the invisible God, Jesus Christ, our route to God. That relationship with God through Christ is one that will never end. Because God is the God of the living. He is not the God of the dead. And the third lesson, the third truth that we have here is that God is worthy of our whole heart. God is worthy of our whole heart. The Pharisees had earlier on sent some of their disciples, some of their students to Jesus with the original question about taxes. In verse 34 onwards, they change their tack now. They're ramping it up a few levels. They're now rolling out an expert, one of the experts in the law as far as they're concerned. And one of these experts in the law are coming and they're testing him with this question, which is the greatest question in the law? Now, out of the three different questions here, this is the one that at times makes us think, well, how do they expect to trip Jesus up? Were they hoping that he would somehow misspeak? Were they hoping that he would say something that might perhaps subtly undermine one of the 613 laws that they had somehow built up around the law of God? What was it that they were expecting when they asked Jesus, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And so this is where we see the progression, because if God has a claim over us, and he does, and if a relationship with God never ends, and that is true, how can we be in that relationship with God? What does he want of us here and now? And the answer that Jesus gives to us in verse 37 to verse 40 here is the answer as to what the law of God summarizes. That God wants us to know a life, a wholehearted, loving life committed to him. Committed to him where love is the driving force. Not this warm, fuzzy feeling that things that might wane as the years go by, but a genuine, heartfelt love that expresses itself in our obedience and our service. Because love that is merely a warm, fuzzy emotion, but doesn't have an impact upon our will, upon our choices, upon our life, well, it's questionable just how accurate that love actually is. Here, it tells us that God is worthy of being loved with all of our heart, soul, and mind. And that as an overflow from connecting to the remarkable love of God, we will then love our neighbors as ourselves. So God is worthy of our complete devotion. And so it paints for us the problem, doesn't it? Because the problem is you and I cannot offer to God our complete devotion. You and I cannot offer to God a love that stems, that comes from an entire heart that's given over to him, or mind that's given over to him, or soul that's given over to him. We're stuck now. Because this is the standard of God. This is what God is worth. But we can't give God what he's worth. So how can we possibly be in a relationship with this God, with the God who has a claim over each one of us? And that is why these three truths, they all converge in the person and work of Jesus Christ. They converge in the person of Jesus Christ because he is the image of God that we need to give back to God, that we come to God through him. That he is the one who permits a relationship with God to begin that nothing can interrupt, because he is the one who was able to love God with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength. He was the one who was enabled to love his neighbor as himself. He's done it. He's lived it. He has loved God and others perfectly. Against the life of Jesus, there is not a single indiscretion, a single moment whereby this standard of God's love was somehow where it slipped. It never did. He lived this life perfectly. We're trying to teach the children, aren't we, with our new city catechisms, that the law of God says we love God with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind. We love our neighbors as ourselves. We're trying to teach the kids that since the fall, no one has been able to keep the law of God perfectly. None of us have. Or the correct answer is, actually from our New City Catechism, is that no human has been able to keep the law of God perfectly. But the God-man has, Jesus Christ. He is the one who has perfectly obeyed, lived out that life that we could never live, died the death that we deserve, so that we might be welcomed into a relationship with him. And so it all revolves around Jesus. The big claim that Jesus gives truths that help us understand life, well, that's true. Who am I? Why am I here? What is the purpose of life? And as I've said on many occasions over the years, every one of us at some point will be confronted with these questions. Things will happen that will leave us stunned by how life has unfolded. And we'll be left asking these bigger questions. Frequently, these questions come to us in the aftermath of a bereavement or some tragedy or some life crisis. And we're left asking, just who am I? What is the point of life? Just what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to live? These questions are answered by Jesus in these verses here. Who are you? You are an image bearer of God with a dignity, with a worth that no other part of this created world has. You reflect the image of God, albeit imperfectly, but you have a worth that's given to you by your Maker. And as such, because he is your Maker, he has a claim on your life. What is the point of life? I mean, if everything in this life that's good ultimately fails, what is the point of life? Well, the point of life is to be in a relationship that will never fail, with one that will never let us down. Because every relationship that we have in this world, we will let others down in that relationship, they will let us down. But there's a relationship whereby, even though we may let God down, he will never let us down. Because his part of the covenant that he enters into, that agreement with us, his part will never fail, because he will constantly, continually keep his people. And that relationship will last into eternity. And so today, as we think of Christians who impacted our lives, who no longer walk on this earth, rather have been ushered into the nearer presence of Jesus. We think of them today that God is still their God. Whether it's family members, whether it's friends, whether it's those who led us to Christ in that first place and they've now gone to glory, that God is still their God because he is the God of the living and they are alive. And how are we supposed to live? How are we supposed to live in this world? Well, we're supposed to live with that recognition that life is found in God and in God alone. And so Jesus, he speaks from the position of authority. And the final section of this chapter reminds us of that, not simply in the sense that when Jesus comes back to them with a particular question that they're unable to answer it, even the expert, the theological expert of the day, is unable to answer this question that comes from Psalm 110 as to how David can be both called the son of David and yet also speak about the Lord as being the one that he has to submit to. Jesus has authority because of who he is. That he is the Messiah, the one from all eternity. The Messiah who will come not simply to secure some physical, political liberation, but this Messiah that will come and will rule forevermore in accordance with his grace and mercy. That he has authority. So ultimately, we're asking today about the authority in your life. Where does it rest? Does it rest with yourself? Or does it rest with the God who has a claim on your life? Does it rest in the God who is in a relationship with you through Christ, the one who lived that perfect life we couldn't live, died the death that we should have died? Where does the authority of your life lie? The correct answer to that question would be, the authority of our life lies in the mercy of God to us in Christ Jesus. We're going to finish there.